Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Andrew McDermott. Can chloroquine be used to treat COVID-19 patients? Today, I welcome back biochemist Michael Behe, professor of biological sciences at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, and a senior fellow at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Behe is author of Darwin's Black Box, named one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century by National Review and World Magazine, as well as the follow-up, The Edge of Evolution, and his most recent book, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. Michael, welcome back.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be with you as always.
Yes, thank you. Well, chloroquine is in the news at the moment as a possible weapon against the novel coronavirus. You wrote about chloroquine in your book, The Edge of Evolution, The Search for the Limits of Darwinism. So I thought you'd be a great person to speak to get us up to speed on what this is and how it might possibly help in our fight against the coronavirus.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, can we start by telling us what chloroquine is and why it was important in the past?
Well, the story begins 500 or so years ago, turns out, when some Spanish explorers were in South America for the first time, and they discovered that the bark of a tree called the cinchona tree, which was pointed out to them by the indigenous folks of South America, had medicinal properties. And it turns out that it could cure malaria. Malaria, as you know, is this very deadly disease, which is transmitted by mosquitoes, and it's due to some little single-celled parasite growing inside a person who has become infected. And it can be deadly and debilitating. And malaria was a big problem back in Europe as well. So when the Spaniards went back to the continent, they took some with them. And it turns out some royalty had malaria at the time, and they gave the drug to them, or the cinchona bark, which is a source of a drug called quinine. And the royalty chewed on the bark, and they were cured, and then quinine was famous in Europe, and explorers and other folks tried to grow the cinchona tree for its medicinal properties. If you fast forward, though, up into the 20th century, it turns out in the 1930s, some German chemists tried to make an artificial chemical that was similar to quinine, because quinine was pretty limited in its supply. And eventually they came up with chloroquine. They invented chloroquine, which was easy to make chemically and easy to manufacture, and turned out to be as effective against malaria as quinine. And after World War II, it became very widely used. People were optimistic that we could kill off malaria in the whole world completely. But then malaria developed resistance to chloroquine, and so it hasn't been used for a few decades for that purpose anymore, to treat malaria at least.
Okay. And so why is this resistance relevant to the discussion of design and evolution?
Well, for many drugs that tested in the laboratory show activity against malaria, that'll kill malaria in a test tube, in a culture. If you give them to a patient in a clinic who's suffering from malaria, the malaria in the patient, that is growing in the patient, will spontaneously develop resistance to it. But that's not true of chloroquine. For chloroquine, eventually malaria can develop resistance, but it takes on average maybe a billion patients, not every patient, but a billion patients to develop resistance. And I wrote about this in my book, The Edge of Evolution. It turns out that in order to become resistant to chloroquine, the single-cell malaria parasite has to have not one mutation, but two different mutations. And since mutation is random, the odds of getting those two mutations together is the odds squared. And it turns out that getting the first one is something like one in 10 billion or so. And that sounds like a lot, and it is, but there is more than that in a single person who is infected with malaria. But if you have to get two mutations, then that's one in 10 billion times one in 10 billion. And that's hard even for malaria to do. So it took decades for malaria to develop resistance to chloroquine. And I use that as an example in my book, The Edge of Evolution, to show the difficulty that a blind Darwinian process, even if it's backed up by natural selection, the difficulty it has of getting two coordinated mutations in order to do something. And since life, cells, certainly humans, all animals and plants, their cells are tremendously coordinated and engineered and have cooperative systems, there would have to be a lot of cooperative developments in the history of life. And I argued in the book that that is very, very far beyond what I called, yes, the edge of evolution. Malaria was the example. It was the first example in the early 2000s of something that we saw required two separate mutations. And that points very strongly to limits on what Darwinism can do. It can do some things, but it can't do all that much.
Sure. Well, how might chloroquine and its chemical relative hydroxychloroquine work against COVID-19?
Well, it turns out that all cells, well, there are, you know, factories, they make things, they break things down, they import things, they export things. And one of the things they do is digest materials that aren't necessary anymore. In the malaria parasite, that single-celled organism that's transmitted by mosquito, it takes material into the cell and it has a little compartment called its digestive vacuole. And that breaks down proteins and it uses that material to help build more of the malarial cells. But chloroquine interferes with the ability of that digestive vacuole to work. And in particular, it clogs it up and the parasite dies kind of from indigestion. In other circumstances too, chloroquine can interfere with things that are analogous to that digestive vacuole in malaria. We all have things called lysosomes in our cells. And they're called the garbage dumps of the cell or the junkyards of the cell. And those are responsible for breaking things down that aren't needed for the cell anymore. The cell brings things in from the outside of it when a virus attaches to the cell membrane, the membrane kind of wraps around it and it pinches off into the inside of the cell and it forms something called an endosome. And the important thing is that the endosomes are headed for the lysosome. And as they're headed there, they begin to change. They begin to accumulate acid in them to help in the digestion. And it turns out that the virus, including coronavirus, needs that acid development to allow it to escape from the lysosome into the cell at large. And chloroquine interferes with the acidification of that compartment. It messes up the ability of the lysosome to become as acidic as it usually is. And so the virus can't escape. So it's stuck and essentially it dies. And its chemical relative, hydroxychloroquine, does pretty much the same thing. The little extra piece, the hydroxy piece, is just a little chemical group added to chloroquine to help make it more soluble in water. Chloroquine is kind of an oily molecule, and that can cause problems in people who take it for malaria. But with the hydroxy group, it makes it more water soluble, and that helps a bit.
Okay. So it's possible that the coronavirus would develop resistance to chloroquine, but it could buy us some time. Is that how you would put it?
Well, yeah, sure. It's how it would develop resistance is kind of an open question, because it would be binding almost certainly to a protein that's different, or to a place in the lysosome of people that is different from the digestive vacuole of the malarial parasite. So what it takes to stop chloroquine from doing that job, it took two mutations in malaria. What it would take in humans is an open question. It certainly may be able to develop resistance eventually, but whether it's faster or slower or actually impossible, a lot of work needs to be done to see.
Yeah. Well, I know they're throwing whatever they can at the coronavirus right now. Are they actively working with chloroquine right now with patients? Do you know what the status is?
Yeah, I just read an article in Science, the journal Science, which is one of the top journals in the world, saying that the World Health Organization has organized a study, a transnational study from scientists across the world on something like the top 40 most promising drugs for treatment of COVID-19. And they included both chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine in the study, along with some antiviral drugs that had been developed for work against AIDS and other things. Essentially, what they're doing is looking at a lot of drugs that have already been approved for use in humans for other purposes, and saying to themselves, well, they've been approved, so we know they can be used safely, at least under some conditions. And if any of those have anti-coronavirus properties, then they can be used a whole lot more quickly than a drug that hasn't been tested for safety to date.
Okay. And chloroquine certainly has. Is it still used today, or has it been out of action for a while?
Yes, it is used today. It's actually used in some antiviral cases for other kinds of viruses like Zika virus. And it's also used in some instances to treat arthritis and related diseases. And it kind of probably works through this lysosomal mechanism by messing up the lysosome that somehow helps in a number of different circumstances.
Okay. So certainly a ray of hope, even though we're in the initial stages of looking at things. Mike, I want to thank you for explaining this to us, helping us understand what chloroquine is and how it might possibly help with this global pandemic that's on our hands.
My pleasure, and I hope some of the scientists find something that works pretty soon.
For sure. Well, you can read more of Mike Behe's discussion of chloroquine in his book, The Edge of Evolution. And you can visit michaelbehe.com for access to videos, articles, courses with Mike Behe, and more. That's at www.michaelbehe.com. Of course, you can catch other episodes of ID the Future wherever podcasts are found, or via idthefuture.com on the web. I'm Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.